On 88.1 WIPR, I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Maryland Morning. Continuing our Focus on the County series this morning, a conversation with first-term Frederick County Executive Jan Gardner. Elected in 2014, Ms. Gardner is Frederick's first county executive as they've transitioned from a commissioner system to a charter system. A Democrat, Jan Gardner is overseeing one of the fastest-growing counties in the state, which is wrestling with the impulse for development in an area with a long-standing agricultural tradition. I'll talk to County Executive Jan Gardner about what's ahead for Frederick County, Baltimore's neighbor to the west. Plus, the versatile jazz and classical pianist Jeffrey Chappelle joins me to talk about his latest project, a new band called Otherworld, a jazz quartet that fuses Middle Eastern and Western classical and jazz traditions. They're streaming a concert from Kensington tomorrow night, and this morning we'll have a preview. Nathan's got the local news. Maryland Morning starts right after these headlines.
I'm producer Kathleen Cahill. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, and 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Thanks, Nathan. Good morning, everybody. On 88.1 WIPR, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we're going to begin with another installment in our Focus on the Counties series. I'm joined by Frederick County Executive Jan Gardner. Ms. Gardner is 59 years old and a native of northwestern Pennsylvania. She moved to Frederick County in the early 1990s, where her husband's family has resided for six generations. She's a mother of three adult children. She and her husband now live in the city of Frederick. Ms. Gardner is a Democrat and Frederick County's first county executive. She holds an MBA from Xavier University. She served as Frederick County Commissioner and the president of Frederick County Commissioners before being elected as the county executive back in 2014. It's great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
So you are the first county executive in the city of Frederick because the system of government changed a couple of years ago. It went from a commissioner system to what they refer to as a charter system. Tell folks what that means. What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that instead of deciding and managing the county by committee, which is what we do on a commissioner form of government where the legislative and executive branches are combined, charter government separates the executive and legislative components. So as the county executive, I'm really responsible for managing the county and setting the agenda. And the council is the legislative branch. So a lot of people are familiar with it because charter's been in place in some of the larger counties in Maryland for a number of years. But it is new to our county. And so one of the first things I had to do as the first county executive was to make sure we stood up charter government and made it work.
What's been the reaction? I mean, I would imagine there's some pushback to change of any kind, because there usually is. Human beings tend to confront change with a good degree of skepticism.
I think the transition has gone relatively well. I think the challenges that have been probably most apparent to the public have been some of the council members that were previous commissioners who had more of that executive authority in the past and now don't have it. They've struggled with that. They have not really wanted to cede some of that executive authority that they used to have. So there's been a little bit of tension in that regard. But in terms of services and what people see, I think that it's gone very smoothly and that most people are happy with it. I think it has allowed us to have a much more effective government. It certainly streamlines the management. All the division directors have one person to report to and one person set in their direction, which is a lot clearer than having five people do that.
Sure, and that was the impetus for it, right?
It was. So, you know, in 2012, it was on the ballot, and it passed by a 2-to-1 margin after having been on the ballot in the early 90s previously, where it failed by a 2-to-1 margin. So I think people were ready for it. And most of the feedback I receive is that people are pleased with it.
Mm-hmm. With all big changes like that, when the very system itself is renovated, as it were, have you found that there's been any unintended consequences? I mean, oftentimes when any bit of legislation is passed, a couple of years down the road, folks find these unintended consequences. Have you encountered any of those?
Well, we found a few. We really have some time limitations, particularly with the budget for the county council, that has really not given them enough time to really review and debate the budget because of the time frame they would need to advertise for a change in the budget. That being 2 weeks, they have a 5-week time period to review and vote on the budget. So if they want to make any substantive change, they have to do it within a 2-week period. And so we do have a charter amendment in to expand the time frame for reviewing the budget. We've also had a few other minor things that we can really address internally or by law or policy rather than having to change the charter itself. The charter should be, you know, for substantive changes so that you don't have a whole list of charter amendments for the public to try to absorb that are really functional rather than policy driven.
On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning. It's our Focus on the County series. I'm Tom Hall, joined in the studio by Frederick County Executive Jan Gardner. Ms. Gardner, there seems to be tension around the Ethics Commission in Frederick. There's a vote actually this evening within the Ethics Commission voting on new operating procedures, the way they're going to function. Explain what the Ethics Commission is and why you think it needs to get tweaked a little bit in terms of how it operates.
Well, the Ethics Commission is a body that's appointed right now by the county executive, confirmed by the council, and they enforce our ethics laws, and that includes conflict of interest provisions for all the elected officials and our division directors. And it was controversial during the term of the prior administration, and they actually weakened the ethics laws. So one of the things I ran for office on was to restore trust in government and to do that through stronger ethics laws. So we have very strong reporting requirements, disclosure on communications, for instance, on land use issues, and that you don't even see in some other counties. So I appointed an ethics task force when I first came into office to recommend changes to the laws, and they did that within 6 months. Those laws have passed through the county council, and now the Ethics Commission itself is adopting new procedures to implement those changes.
Because evidently there's a colleague of yours, a former commissioner who's now a councilman, a Republican named Kirby DeLauder, who was approved by the Ethics Commission to be allowed to bid on capital improvement projects in the county, even though he is a county commissioner. And you overruled that decision. A couple of members of the commission resigned in protest of that. Explain how that's come down, and you know, is the Ethics Commission part of this new system? You know, the charter system versus commissioner system, and is this part of the growing pains here?
Well, I think it's really an ethical issue itself. I don't think elected officials should be doing business with the county, because I do think there is both a real and perceived conflict of interest there. I did disagree with that Ethics Commission recommendation, and I didn't really overrule it. I issued an executive order that directed staff to not receive bids from elected officials, which has the effect of overruling it. Overruling it, but I can't overrule law. So their decision still stands. But we've also come out with an independent way to appoint the Ethics Commission. We actually now have the League of Women Voters takes the lead, and they put together independent nominating committee that interviews applicants and makes recommendations to me for appointment. And I really can only appoint people that come out of that process. And so we have a much more independent appointment process as well. So I think to ensure the public trust, you can't have elected businesses profiting from their position, either real or perceived. I don't think elected officials should be doing business with the county and bidding on projects. And I think the majority of the people agree with that. So I found great support in that position. And I am going to try to make sure that people can trust that decisions are made based on the good of the public without undue influence from any elected officials.
I mean, I think a whole lot of folks would agree that, you know, elected officials doing business with the county has some, you know, a lot of minefields to negotiate. But there is a commission, you know, and if the commission is empowered to decide this case, that case, the next case, and they make a decision, you know, if they're subject to having it changed by the county executive, that calls into question some things as well, doesn't
it?
Well,
they made an advisory opinion in that case. It wasn't a ruling that there had been a violation of the ethics ordinance. So I think I don't think I overstepped my bounds in any way, shape, or form. You know, when you run to restore trust in government, you have to support strong ethics laws. And those laws apply to me as well as to all the other elected officials. And so, you know, I have to report when somebody calls me or emails me on an issue that is before the council as well as something that I could veto. And I think that's right and proper. So I ran on stronger ethics rules. I support them. These were the rules that were in place before the prior administration. If you look across the state, almost every county has specific rules to not allow elected officials to do business with the county. And so I think we're consistent with that. And I don't think I've abused my authority through the executive order process.
And you're confident that the changes that you'll be making, or the commission itself will be making, to its procedures and to how the commissioners are chosen and to who recommends them, et cetera, you're confident that that will get things to a place you're
comfortable? I think that will certainly help. And it takes us to a place where other counties haven't gone, where they have this independent appointment process. And we have changed and strengthened our laws that address conflicts of interest, and do the law now says, the ethics laws now say, that county elected officials can't do business with the county or profit from their positions.
Today, the big news here in Baltimore is the Department of Justice report on police misconduct with the City of Baltimore Police Department. Talk about the police department in Frederick and its relationship with communities of color and minority communities. I note that there's roughly 145, 150 people on the police force in Frederick. Frederick County, there are only 10 Black officers, you know, less than 10 Hispanic officers. Are you comfortable that the growing diversity of Frederick County is being represented in the law enforcement community?
Well, first of all, you're quoting the statistics from the City of Frederick Police, and the City of Frederick Police report to the mayor of the City of Frederick. In the county, we have the sheriff's office with sheriff deputies, and we do have about 300 sheriff deputies countywide, mm-hmm. In addition to the Frederick Police, and we also have small police forces in Thurmont and Brunswick. So there's been a longstanding issue of trying to hire diversity throughout all those police forces. And the Human Relations Commission in our county has regularly met, particularly with the city police, to try to talk about how to improve those statistics. So I think there are goals within all of our law enforcement agencies to do that. And tonight, the Human Relations Commission is actually having a forum on community policing and really talking about some of the issues that have been raised with Black Lives Matter, the shootings across the country. And I do think there is a big effort towards community policing, particularly within the City of Frederick.
All right, we'll talk a little bit more about that and some other things when we come back for a break for the news. If I could impose on you to stick around for a little bit, I appreciate you being here. Jan Gardner, she's the Frederick County Executive, the first county executive to serve the County of Frederick. We'll take a break for the news, and then we'll come back and we'll have more with Ms. Gardner. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Here's Nathan.
Thanks, Tom. You're listening to the Maryland Morning Podcast, a service of your public radio, WYPR, in Baltimore. Find more podcasts at WYPR.org and tell us what you think by email, mdmorning@WYPR.org. Now, back to the podcast.
Morning again, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. It's Maryland Morning. Welcome back. According to census data released last year, Frederick County is the fifth fastest growing county in the state of Maryland. If you're just joining us, Frederick County Executive Jan Gardner is with me here in Studio A, and we continue our Focus on the County series. That growth, Ms. Gardner, has led to all sorts of opportunities and challenges, as folks in your business tend to say. One of them, the challenges, is in education and school overcrowding. You've got some schools that are literally bursting at the seams. Some are like 150% capacity. You serve on the state's 21st Century School Facilities Commission. This is something you've given a lot of thought to. Talk about the task forces that you have developed and appointed to address this problem, and where do things stand with new school construction in the county? I know you have some goals to get a couple of new buildings up and running by 2018.
Well, we saw a big increase in the cost of school construction in the last year. We're building a new Frederick High School. It's a replacement high school. And we saw the price go up by close to 30% over the course of a year. And that was certainly hard for us to fund and then keep every other school project in place.
Yeah, it went from about $100 million to $115.
Yeah, yes.
A lot of money.
It actually went from $84 million to $115 over a little bit longer period of time. It had a couple steps going up. But we tried to keep the schools behind that in in track. And we had a creative solution where we had some developers actually help to forward fund the state share of a couple of elementary schools to keep those in line for construction. And those were both needed in places where the schools are close to 150% of capacity right now. So by the time they're built, those schools could be at 160% of capacity. So that's a big issue. It really does impact educational outcomes. So I have appointed two groups. One is to look at how can we reduce the cost of school construction by 8 to 10%. And that group has is kind of an in-the-weeds group. We have people from the school system and facilities planning. We have an architect. We have people who do HVAC work, really people who do this work. And they are coming out with some really interesting recommendations. And I believe they're going to achieve that goal. And I'll certainly share those with the 21st Century Schools Commission, which we're now kind of calling the Not Commission. And then I have another commission that was I appointed at the request of the county council to look at having the private sector build a school and have the county lease it back. And we did have a specific proposal from a developer to do that, and it really cost significantly more, $50 to $100 million more for the schools they looked at. So it's just not that those proposals were not viable. The county can borrow money at a much lower interest rate than the private sector, and obviously we don't have the interest in making a profit on our school buildings either. So
Is there a reason? Is there one particular thing you can point to that caused the cost of the estimated cost of this to be so wildly off the mark?
I think there's a number of factors that went into the increased cost of school construction. And I think one that nobody talks about is that we're actually building bigger schools. We've been mandated to build more space. And we do use our schools for community purposes. But we now have larger health suites that we're required to do. We're required to use a lot of our schools for weather shelters or emergency shelters. And we also, in Frederick County, try to build oversized gymnasiums, sometimes a second gymnasium, so that we can use them for a park and rec program. So
you didn't design them to be that big at the beginning.
Yeah,
if you start at $84 million, you get to 115. How's that happen?
Well, this is more in general to all projects if you look over the last 10 or 15 years. That project came in because the environment was much more competitive for bidding projects. So we had fewer bids in some cases. Stormwater management laws added to that. The environmental and HVAC and energy efficiency requirements added to that. Prevailing wage added to it. And so there were a whole host of reasons, not just one, why that school came in higher. But part of it is also
those are all things that happened after you started.
That's correct. Yeah. And so it's a very long lead time to have a school go through the state approval process from project planning all the way to funding. And so the environment can change. And, you know, a lot of people went out of business during the recession. So there's fewer people bidding on school projects. They're bidding on some other projects out there that maybe pay more, or they just don't want to get involved with the school projects because there's so many requirements. And so we do bid them out in packages. So there is a roofing package, an HVAC package, and a number of other things. But a lot of the requirements and mandates that came from the state are definitely part of it. For instance, we build all of our schools that are wireless, but we're still mandated to hardwire them as well. And it really doesn't make any sense.
Why is that?
Because that's what the state legislature decided we should do.
And do you have any idea what the reason for that is? That
no,
just seems silly on its face.
I don't know the reason for that, but we also have to pre-qualify contractors twice. And so that's another expense. So, you know, when you look at we really need to look into the weeds at what some of these requirements are and to see how they came to pass and what we can do to kind of take some of those out.
Yeah, well, wiring schools is certainly a good place to start.
That just sounds, it is. So and
silly
you wouldn't,
on its
you wouldn't
face,
know
right?
that.
Yeah, yeah. But you do, just to finish up this little subject, you do expect to have the new Frederick High School up and running by 2018. Will you build one of the other elementary schools that you would hope to build as well?
We're bidding out two elementary schools in November. So, yeah, we're going to build the next two schools on time, and we're doing that through this creative financing package we put together with some of our local development community. And that was a really positive change that most other counties haven't done. One school is in a wealthy area. One school is in an area where there's a lot of poverty and a lot of English as a second language speakers. And we really didn't want to pit those two communities against each other. So we're doing them at the same time.
Frederick County Executive Jan Gardner with me here in Studio A. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Maryland Morning, our Focus on the Counties series. There is a tension, it seems to me, as an outside observer in Frederick, between the long tradition of agricultural and rural lifestyle and the need, because your county is growing so quickly, you've got all sorts of people coming into the county. It's become a very popular, you know, sort of bedroom community, both to D.C. and to Baltimore. How do you navigate that need for growth and the need or the impulse to, you know, to maintain the rural character of the county? One example perhaps would be with this downtown Frederick Hotel and Conference Center that you have supported and other people have supported, and there are very many people who think that that's not a good idea. They're saying that there are already a couple of other hotel and conference centers being built with completely private funding in other places other than the city, and they're wondering why a private public partnership is necessary in downtown Frederick. Can you tell us about that story?
Well, I see that the Downtown Hotel Conference Center as a real economic development project. If you've been to the city of Frederick, the downtown is very vibrant. It's very booming. The public investment in Carroll Creek and the public investment in the East Street Extension, the fact that we put a public library as an anchor to Carroll Creek, some of those public investments were very intentional. They happened over time, and they've really helped our downtown to thrive. And it's really important as we try to attract millennials. We think the Downtown Hotel Conference Center is just the next piece in that series. It was initiated by our major employers group. We only have one other hotel conference center in the county. It's in the suburban area. It currently exists. There's a proposal to renovate it that has been approved by the county. I'm unaware of anybody else building another hotel conference center, but we do feel to have that downtown and to make it walkable is important. To build downtown is more expensive. It requires parking, so that is not required out in a suburban area where there's surface parking. Also, building along Carroll Creek is a bit more expensive in a constrained space. So we feel it's important for the public to support this because it will spur economic development. You know, there was opposition to burying the electric lines underground, the city of Frederick, opposition to the Carroll Creek Linear Park project itself, which has been fabulous. There was opposition to putting the public library downtown and expanding it there on Carroll Creek. But I think when people look back at it, they say, wow, those were good decisions. They've made a difference. And I think the Downtown Hotel Conference Center will be exactly the same. I think it will help economic development in the city of Frederick. And it helps us address the very issue you raise, because growth should be happening in the city of Frederick. That's our job hub. That's where most of our jobs are. That's where a lot of our millennials want to live. We have a booming senior population. They also want to live in that downtown walkable area with amenities, public transportation, and so forth. So I think it's a good project. And I think it's broadly supported. I've heard from hundreds of people who support it and a handful of people who have opposed it. So, you know, the county is going to invest in its public dollars in street improvements and in parking. And the county's invested in every parking deck in the city of Frederick. And, you know, that subsidizes in some ways all the businesses downtown in the city of Frederick, but it makes the city work. And, you know, I think what's good for the city of Frederick is good for the county. And I think it is part of smart growth.
And you are convinced that it would not be possible to build this strictly with private funds, that it requires the public investment. In other words, you're not going to find a private developer willing to come in and pick up the tab.
Well, the private developer is going to pick up 100% of the hotel, and they're going to own the hotel and conference center. So very different model than what you've seen, for instance, here in Baltimore. The city of Frederick is going to own the underlying land and do a long-term land lease on it, and they're going to get 10% of the profit from the conference center. So there is a direct payback to the taxpayers. And I don't think that it would happen without some public investment. And I think the public investment is justified because it will clearly pay back in terms of tax dollars and jobs.
But there's no TIF,
right? People in Baltimore are very sensitive to the notions of TIFs. And
there could be a TIF, but the TIF would be like $5 or $6 million, very small compared to what you're looking at here in the city of Baltimore.
We're looking at a little more.
We have a policy where we can't TIF more than 50% of the projected tax revenue from a project, and I think that's wise.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of land use and the Planning Commission, I mean, you've got issues involving the commission, as I understand it, disallowing weddings to take place in agricultural areas. They're shutting down wedding events and stuff like that, things setting up stuff on farms and stuff. Do I have that right? I mean, is the land use issue something that occupies a good bit of your time?
Land use issues are always important to the public, and we want to make sure that we protect our rural areas from sprawl. I am a big proponent of that, and I also think we should time growth with our ability to provide schools and roads. However, the wedding venue issue, one wedding venue has been shut down, and they built that without any permits of any kind at all. So that was the issue. It was not a Planning Commission issue. It was really a permitting and inspections issue. We had a complaint about it. We went out and inspected it, found out all the buildings were built without any permits of any kind at all. So, and that became more complicated because the business owner was not the property owner, and the property owner decided he didn't want the business on his property. So it even went a little bit beyond that. So
there's a little drama for you.
That became a little bit of a drama, but it's not the widespread drama that you might think it plays out to be. I think
it rivals the mother of the bride, doesn't it?
Well, you know, we certainly want the mothers of the brides and the brides themselves
to
be happy and to have a place to go for their weddings. And a lot of other venues stepped up to take those brides in the near term and in the long term, so that they could be happy on the best day of their lives.
So speaking of happy, the issue of medical cannabis is also on your plate. There's a public hearing on it Monday about a bill. Each county has to set up licenses for allowing people to grow cannabis. Where do you see that heading?
Well, the issue that's before the council is whether we should allow medical cannabis growers in ag zones. We already permit them in industrial and commercial zones, which I think is appropriate. Most of the applicants we've had have wanted to operate in kind of a warehouse setting where they have security and a controlled environment. We have at least one application in ag zone, and that's not currently permitted by our zoning ordinance. So they're talking about it. It's a second round for it. And our Farm Bureau, our Agriculture Business Council, are opposed to allowing these operations in ag.
Yeah, well, we'll see how that goes, and we will continue to follow it and have you back on the show to talk more about Frederick County. Thanks so much for coming. Appreciate
it. Thank you for having me.
Jan Gardner is Frederick County's first county executive. For more information about what's going on in Frederick County and a link to their Livable Frederick website, come to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Ahead on the program, Jeffrey Chappelle is a terrific pianist and a good friend. I've done a bunch of concerts with him. He's going to come talk about his new band, Other World. But first, it's time for the Environment in Focus with Tom Felton.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wipr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Music from the jazz quartet Other World. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. My next guest is Jeffrey Chappelle, the pianist in this global jazz group that also includes Jake Kohlhaas on guitar, Chris Taylor on bass, and the percussionist Jake Marinari. Jeffrey Chappelle is the director of jazz studies at Goucher College. This band grew out of his work at Goucher. Let's listen to a little more of this track called Candlelight from their debut CD. Beautiful tune, beautifully played. Jeffrey Chappelle is the tunist and the player. Jeff, it's nice to see you, man. How you
doing? Same here, Tom.
So you and I have committed several crimes together over the years. We've done a bunch of concerts together, and we even were both on the faculty at Goucher College for a long time, where you still are.
Right.
I retired a couple of years ago. But this group actually grew out of your work at Goucher. Tell us how it came to be.
Well, it all started when I was a boy. Now, that's how I start every story. But actually, all kidding aside, the Goucher connection is this. I have a lot of students there that come through my jazz studies program, and these other three musicians in this group all are alumni of Goucher College. And in one form or another, they were my students there. They were in some of my classes. Now, you might think that I formed the group, but actually, Jake Marinari, the drummer, invited me into the group one day when we were jamming, and I said, yes, I'll join this group. And I feel really lucky that I got that invitation, because it's really been a success story ever since then.
Yeah. And it's great to work with folks in our business. I've always found that it's great to work with people who are a lot older than me and a lot younger than me. I mean, you learn a lot from both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. Well, 2 years ago, we decided to do the group, and we spent a year basically getting our musical vision together so that the music that each of us writes is within a certain kind of aesthetic groove, but it all sounds like Otherworld, even though it's written by all four of us. Each musician composes a tune, and then when we rehearse, we all collaborate together to make the arrangement of it.
Let's listen to one of the other tunes on the album. This is a cut called Full Moon. Looked at the album credit closely enough, but when you say all four of you compose it, do you all give each other, composing credits on the album?
No, I get the composing credit for that tune.
Yeah.
But
there's a lot of input from the other guys.
I take the tune to the group, mm-hmm. and then they listen to it, and the drummer says, well, that makes me want to play this, and the bass player says, I therefore want to react to it this way. The guitarist says, I'm going to use these chord voicings, and so on. And that's how we do it with all of our tunes. One of us brings the tune to the group, and we go from there.
And you each have different musical identities, different musical backgrounds. I mean, you were actually the first pianist I heard play in Baltimore. I moved here in 1982. The Meyerhof was about to open. They had a hard hat concert. You may not even remember that you played this job. And you played, I think, a movement of the Mendelssohn Piano Concerto.
Right.
So I knew you as a classical pianist, and then you and I went on to do many concerts of classical repertoire together.
Right.
But the other guys in the group weren't necessarily classically trained. So it's interesting. It's a mishmash of perspectives.
Well, you might say that's how the name of the group came around, because the bass player has a pretty heavy funk streak going on there, and the drummer has a lot of Middle Eastern training, and the guitarist a lot of jazz training going on. So, when you put all of this together, it creates another world. So there you have it.
Other world, right. You guys won a Global Music Award. I mean, folks in music these days, at least in non-classical music, tend to categorize, they're big in the categories, Would you describe Otherworld as a global music band? I mean, what's the term that you like to attach to it?
We call it contemporary jazz, And it's really hard to give it a particular title. A Global Music Award is actually a prestigious international competition. That's just the title of the awards. And they have many different categories, like the Grammys, you know, they'll have best soundtrack or best new album or whatever. And so in the category of album, we were in the top 10 winners. And that was part of our success story professionally, was getting that award. Because after we had been together for a year, we got a grant from Goucher College to make the debut album, which we did at Blue House Studios in Silver Spring. And then I entered the album in the competition, and lo and behold, we got the Global Music Award. And we've gone on from there professionally to do a lot of things. We've given concerts at Sandy Spring Museum, Andy Music. We were part of the inaugural season for Goucher Summer Stage Concerts. And, you know, it's a funny thing. A week after we released the album, I got an email from a jazz internet station based in London, England, asking permission to play one of our tracks online. And I'm like, how did they know about us? And then a week later, I got an email from a student of mine who lives in Nairobi saying he'd been walking through the shopping mall and he heard the music coming over the speakers. I'm like, this is amazing.
You know you've made it when you're in the Nairobi shopping malls.
Well,
that's great.
It's just sort of a, it's just sort of a phenomenon. These keep happening, these little things.
Yeah.
You know, like I saw
and what's your take on the jazz scene? I mean, you've had your foot in the classical scene, you've had your foot in the education scene here in Maryland. You know, not just in Baltimore, but you teach at the Levine School in Washington and stuff.
Right.
What's your take? It certainly has changed an awful lot in the 35 years we've known each other.
Well, the jazz scene, you know, it's small and strong. That's what I like to say about it. Or even the classical music scene. You know, there are all these different styles of music, and you know, people like to say that things are, you know, going out of style or this or that. But, you know, once something is established, it can become small and strong. I think that all these scenes are very healthy and very much alive.
Well, it's always good to see you, man. And it's great to hear this new album, all the tracks. This last track that we're going to go out with is a tune called One Summer Night from Otherworld. Jeff Chappelle, good to see you. And break a leg tomorrow night.
Thanks so much.
Jeffrey Chappelle is the pianist in the jazz quartet Otherworld. Otherworld will be playing and live streaming a concert tomorrow night, 8 o'clock at Blue House Productions in Silver Spring. We've got a link to details on how to attend or to tune in on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday, Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen, the health commissioner of Baltimore City, and a conversation about the Justice Department report on the Baltimore City Police Department that will be officially released today. Until then, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Garrison Keillor's up next with the Writer's Almanac. Have a great day.